Meeting will come to order. Well, you did it again. You made it in spite of the weather out there. So we're ready to start. Representative Tice, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I will move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Tice moves the minutes of February 13th. Any changes, corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are adopted. We have the pleasure of the commissioner and her Minnesota housing staff with us today to talk about the governor's announcement from yesterday, and we welcome you to the committee, and you may begin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me back. Yesterday was a big day for the new administration, with the governor releasing his budget proposal. He reaffirmed his commitment to One Minnesota and talked about his investment priorities for education, health care, and community prosperity. It was clear in his remarks and in the specific budget and bonding proposals that the governor knows that having a home is foundational to everything we want in life for everyone in the state of Minnesota. As a father and a former school teacher, he understands that when a child doesn't have a stable home, it impacts the whole classroom, and that a stable home is foundational to a good education, that homework starts with home. He knows that at the center of community prosperity are homes. A housing shortage or high housing costs that don't line up with people's incomes can be a competitive disadvantage for businesses. And our housing market can remain a competitive advantage for the state. He knows that our homes are necessary to health, and as we get older, for healthy aging. Housing is critical to community prosperity. Housing production in Minnesota has not kept pace with the growing housing needs of communities and families across the state. It is a statewide issue, as I've had an opportunity to visit with many of you and with your colleagues in the Senate. Regardless of what part of the state people are from, I am hearing that housing and housing affordability are key issues everywhere. At Minnesota Housing, over the last 3 years, nearly half of the competitive funding that we put out for housing has gone to Greater Minnesota. This is a statewide issue. The other thing that is really clear to me is that when we together focus on data-driven, evidence-based, cost-effective solutions, we see considerable progress. I've seen this at Minnesota Housing as I've gotten to know the agency, in terms of the work that we do, providing first-time home buyers who are households of color with mortgage and down payment assistance. We set the goal of closing the homeownership gap. Now, we're a long ways from it, and we're only a small part of the market, and the rest of the industry needs to set that goal, too. But when we decided to do things differently to target resources to close the homeownership gap for households of color, we saw results. When we decided to end veterans' homelessness, we have seen results. Over a 50% decrease in the number of veterans experiencing homelessness today. And yesterday, the governor said that he wants to be the fourth state in the country to effectively end veterans' homelessness. So this is work where when we set a goal and we really focus on results, we can make a difference. What I want to do today is go over the whole budget recommendation, especially focused on the line items where the governor is proposing new increases. From homelessness to home ownership, from preservation to production, from toddlers to elders, this budget has resources to address the housing needs of Minnesotans. Overall, it would invest $133 million in housing, which is a $28 million increase over the base. So let's go through the details. First, increasing home stability. For folks who know me, those of you who have been up here for a while, we've had an opportunity to interact when I was the executive director at Hearth Connection. At Hearth Connection, I came to believe that it was possible to end homelessness, because I saw us house people who had been homeless for 5, 10, 15, 20, even 30 years. When people are given the opportunity for a home, with no strings attached, just the basic responsibilities of being a tenant. People who are homeless, even for the longest periods of time, can be stably housed. I took that knowledge out to Washington, D.C. as the Deputy Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and we wrote the first ever federal strategy to prevent and end homelessness. And as a result, we actually saw a national movement that resulted in a decline in homelessness during a period after the Great Recession when everybody thought that it would spike. I went on to be a senior advisor at HUD, where I was able to work with the Center for Medicaid to find new ways to finance services for people with disabilities who are homeless, with education, to think about the role that schools play. Data-driven best practices yield results. So on the homelessness front, we start with a $6 million increase for Homework Starts with Home. On any given day, 8,700 students are experiencing housing instability in our schools. This impacts 1,200 schools in 300 school districts in 76 of Minnesota's 87 counties. This is a statewide problem, and school mobility is caused by housing instability. It's one of the greatest challenges that our schools face. If we want to be the number one education state, not only do we need to invest in education, but we need to invest in housing so that children can stay in the same home, go to the same school through the whole school year. The Homework Starts with Home is a program that the legislature has been supporting since 2013, first as a pilot project and then as one-time investments. We believe that this is a program that should be expanded so that we can make a dent on family homelessness and help students succeed in schools. So first, we know what works. Providing housing stability resources stabilizes families and improves a child's education. Second, we've seen that public and private leaders are committing to addressing educational achievement and equity. And third, these investments are leveraging other resources. We have both the University of Minnesota raising research funding to look at the impact of Homework Starts with Home. We also have philanthropy investing in right alongside with us to make sure that the resources are flexible and tailored to community needs. Second, I want to turn to the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. We're proposing, I want to start by showing actually a really great video. Do we have a screen up for that? If we don't, I'll talk.
She knows I talk a lot about education and wanting to be an education governor, and she reminds me often that homework starts with having a home and that it's foundational. If you do not have security at home, if you do not have housing, the idea of a child coming to school to learn is very, very difficult.
Some people feel like, that would never happen to me. Oh, you were smarter than that. I had a great education, so do I. When they get to picking out their rooms, like the biggest, I hadn't smiled in so long. And when I think that, like, that was it for me. And then that was the moment when my thought process changed, when I saw that. Like, that was our moment for us. After the 2 years, that was hard 2 years, but after the 2 years, they both have just, like, shined in their own way. And it's like, I don't really know how to put into words where they, like, how they are now, but they are amazing young ladies right now.
And that by stabilizing their housing, that did translate into stability in school for children as well. And the kids who very often would have been chronically absent when they came into the program, ended up actually stabilizing their attendance in school as well, which is the vital precursor for them to achieve all of their other academic needs.
Now, how can a child succeed, basically, if they worried about after school where they're going to lay their head at, how they're going to eat, where they're going to eat, if they're going to eat? They can't be successful in school. And this program looked deeper into the whole family aspect. Like, we talking about the babies, but if you're going to try to save a child, they still have to go home to the parents. So you have to bring the whole family into it. And I believe this is the first program that I know of that took my whole family into consideration.
One of the challenges with this work is that we know that student homelessness is often invisible. People can't imagine that that's happening in their own communities. But what we see from the data that school personnel provide of who is facing housing instability is that we have homeless students in 76 of Minnesota's 87 counties. That's 1,200 different schools from 300 different school districts. And we know that even that number, 8,700 students enrolled at any single day, we know that that number is still an underestimate. So this is a problem that affects communities all across the state, and it's really critical that we have resources to respond to those needs so that kids have a home to do their homework.
You know, the day that it was 30 degrees below zero, the governor was supposed to fly up to Boys Fort for a meeting with the tribes, and they heard that the plane couldn't take off because it couldn't land because it was so cold. And so we got a call from the governor's office, and he said, you know, kids are home from school today, but some kids don't have a home. And he wanted to go out and be with homeless kids that day. So we went down to People Serving People in Minneapolis, and he and the lieutenant governor and the first lady read to kids, really highlighting the fact that on a snow day, and I was thinking about that this morning because I heard the trip to Moorhead got canceled, and I was worried that we weren't back at the office to pick up the call to find out where the governor wanted to go today, but really highlighting the fact that homework starts with home, and the way for children to succeed in school starts with stable housing. So I want to move on to the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program. In 1993, the Minnesota Legislature created this program to assist families who are homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness. The goal of the program is to make homelessness rare, brief, and if it happens, non-recurring, so people don't come back into homelessness again. It serves all 87 counties, and it funds 20 different grantees. It funds supportive services and direct assistance in order to either, as I said, prevent homelessness or to get families quickly rehoused. Interestingly, it's a model that has been adopted nationally based on work that began here in Hennepin County and in a couple other communities where they were looking at the patterns of families going into shelter and realizing that the system wasn't oriented towards getting those families housed, and that really doing some major modifications to the system focused on rapid rehousing. And so the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program is not only an effective practice here in Minnesota, but it's one that has led to a national model that's completely changed how we address family homelessness, which has also resulted in a pretty dramatic reduction in family homelessness, both here in Minnesota and across the country. So we're looking for a $4 million increase for family homelessness prevention, which also supports family stability and school stability. I want to go on to the Bridges Rental Assistance Program. This program has also been around for quite a long time. It deals with the fact that federal housing assistance has basically flatlined or declined over time. It's a bridge to federal assistance. That bridge has gotten very long in some instances. But for individuals with mental illness, people who might otherwise be institutionalized or homeless, the Bridges Rental Assistance Program provides critical rental assistance funding in order to help those individuals stabilize in their own homes and that housing stability can lead to better mental health. Certainly more consistent access to mental health care, but also just the safety and security of knowing that you have a place to stay. This is also tied in to the work that we're doing in Minnesota related to Olmstead. The Olmstead plan helps individuals with disabilities live in the most integrated settings in the community, and the Bridges rental assistance helps us accomplish that goal. The other piece that we're proposing, and it's a bit of a curveball from a budget perspective, but it's absolutely critical to the work that we're doing on ending homelessness, is an investment in the homeless management information system. I'm highlighting it here because I have an opportunity in a way that my fellow commissioner, Commissioner Lori, has to cover kind of all of Health and Human Services. I have more of an opportunity to talk about our homelessness investments, but we're actually asking that this money be appropriated to the Department of Human Services. The reason that we're asking for that is because they're able to leverage some federal match on IT services, so it allows us to bring some federal dollars in. The bottom line is that the progress that we've made on homelessness is because we have adopted effective data systems that allow us to measure and monitor and improve the way that we do the work. This is not the sexy part of what we do. It is hard to get people to appreciate that the information system is a critical part of accomplishing the goals. But I will tell you, for the last 19 years that I've worked on ending homelessness, we have evolved to a very, very data-driven management theory, and it has been the basis of the results we've been able to accomplish. So we are asking for $2 million to be appropriated to the Department of Human Services. It's also important to realize that all of the state homelessness assistance now requires the grantees to use the homeless management information system. And this provides a comprehensive view of how the federal dollars and the state dollars are impacting families and individuals experiencing homelessness. It helps us monitor how many people are becoming homeless, how long people are homeless, how many people are exiting homelessness, and who comes back. So investments in this information system are absolutely critical to the work that we do. I want to move from homelessness to the work that we do building more homes. We need more homes in Minnesota. We need them at all income levels, and we need them all across the state. So the largest program that we have in partnership with you at the legislature is the Economic Development and Housing Challenge, or the Challenge Program. As I mentioned before, the affordability of a home has been a competitive advantage for Minnesota. My guess is that some of you rent a second place to stay here in St. Paul during the legislative session. And if it was anything like my experience going to Washington, D.C., there's a little bit of sticker shock when you realize what it costs to rent a place. I was spending $1,500 a month for an apartment in Washington, D.C. that I barely even saw except to sleep. I kept my home back here in St. Paul the whole time that I was doing this. But the affordability of homes has been a competitive advantage. I mean, even though housing costs are rising here, it's nowhere near the cost of housing on the coasts. And so it's something that we really need to pay attention to as we think about the competitive advantage that we have. So the danger is that the cost of housing is going to limit economic growth and housing and impact housing mobility. You know, and growing the number of homes in Minnesota isn't something that we can do overnight, right? Housing production takes time. So it's something that we have to have a long view on, that we need to get started now, and we need to keep that engine of economic growth going forward. So the governor proposes a $10 million increase this biennium to the Challenge Program, and continuing in the tails with a $2 million increase to the base going forward. The Challenge Program allows Minnesota Housing to provide no-interest deferred loans to for-profit and non-profit developers and local units of government to develop housing. It is a flexible program, which allows it to respond to local needs. What I hear from people in Worthington is different from what I hear from people in St. Cloud, is different from what I hear from people in La Crescent, is different from what I hear from people in St. Paul. So the Challenge Program allows local communities to define their housing priorities, and whether it's single-family homes or affordable rental housing, whether it's preservation or production, the Challenge Program steps in to fill the financing gap to allow more and better housing to exist in communities. At least 50% of the Challenge Program must be used for housing projects that include a financial contribution from non-state resources. Every housing dollar that we invest leverages an extraordinary amount of money from other sources, whether local, federal, or private. The Challenge Program also serves a high percentage of households of color, helping us close the housing gap. In 2017, almost 69% of the families in rental units funded by the Challenge Program were households of color, and 45% on the homeownership side were households of color, largely due to the community-based providers that we partner with in the program. I want to shift with this idea of leverage. As mayors across the state and counties across the state are really appreciating that housing is a challenge that they need to own, right? That it's not something that somebody else is going to solve, but it's a problem that they need to own. We're seeing local communities develop local housing trust funds. We believe that a one-time investment by the legislature could incent the creation of more local housing trust funds that allow communities to use their own dollars with some match from the state to leverage other dollars in order to meet their local housing needs. We think that $2 million would allow us to incent between 7 and 13 communities to create housing trust funds. And, of course, once a community creates a housing trust fund, you know, that's an opportunity for them to continue to make investments that will endure over time. I want to move next to home ownership. Today, Minnesota Housing, with our own resources as the state's housing bank, makes investments in home ownership capacity. We're asking the state to supplement the investments that we make so that we can reach more households. We could serve more people who are thinking about home ownership that maybe need to do a little bit of work on their debt and credit, that maybe needs to better understand the responsibilities of home ownership. I was talking with a group of nonprofits that are interested in this last night, and I said, you know, I've been in a relationship for 19 years, and the scariest day of my relationship was the day I signed a 30-year mortgage. You know, I mean, it's a daunting thing to enter into that. So our home ownership education really helps people, maybe who grew up in families who only ever rented, understand home ownership. You know, home ownership is so important because it's the way that we build wealth. Right? Home ownership is the single biggest factor in how we build wealth. And so there are 64,000 households of color in Minnesota who earn enough money to be able to pay a mortgage, but maybe they don't have enough wealth to do the down payment. So, like, helping folks understand how they can break into home ownership so that they can have an opportunity to build wealth for generations to come is a critical part of the work that we do. So we're asking for the legislature to partner with us on this. Finally, I want to talk about the preservation side of it, preserving the homes that we have. I have an 82-year-old father who's in the hospital right now, and I have never thought about safety in the home as much as I've been thinking about it for the last 6 weeks. We live in homes that were designed for when we were young. And all the demographic data says that we're going to live much longer than previous generations. But it also tells us that that we're going to die poorer because we've lived longer, and we're all probably going to face some mobility challenges as we go. It sounds like a downer, but it's just a fact, and I think it's a fact that we just need to confront, and the more that we can do it up front instead of dealing with it after the fall, the better off that we're going to do. The Rehabilitation Loan Program allows us to make loans that help homeowners age in place. There are 51,500 senior households who are income eligible for these loans, but we're only serving about 260 households a year. This is obviously a place where we also need to partner with others, and we need to get, you know, the healthcare sector and others engaged in figuring out how to make our homes safe. But this is a critical part of what we do with deferred and forgivable loans. So we're asking for a $1 million increase to the Rehabilitation Loan Program.
That's a staggering statistic. I hadn't seen that. 51,000 senior households income eligible, but we're only getting to 260 of them.
Well, and 51,500 and growing, right? If you think about the pace at which Minnesota is aging, that the whole country is aging. When I was out in D.C., some of the funnest work that I got to do was with AARP. It turns out that the president of AARP, her first job was at HUD. She understands housing policy. So even though AARP's priorities are retirement security, Medicare, and Medicaid, she completely understood that retirement security is about your home, right? And the value of your home and the safety of your home, and that Medicare and Medicaid spending are completely contingent on people having safe and stable housing. So we were able to do a ton of work in order to highlight, it was actually HUD's 50th birthday when we were there, so we got a big AARP card. We got welcomed into the club. But, I mean, this is the future of America, aging, and our ability to age in place, right? The baby boom wants to stay at home. The vast majority of people want to remain in their own home. And yet when you take a look at the configuration of those homes, there's stairs access, you know, the bathroom's on the second floor. The bedrooms on the second floor. This is something that we really have to take a hard look at. The other piece that we've included is an item that has no fiscal impact for the state budget. It has a huge impact for people who live in manufactured home communities, and this is the Relocation Trust Fund. What we do today is that we collect money from manufactured home communities to go into a relocation trust fund so that if a community closes, we're able to assist the residents with relocation. Because we have seen a number of these communities close of late, and a lot of it has gotten a fair amount of publicity when it's happened because of how it's happened, we believe that it's important to simply raise the fund's balance from $1 million to $3 million, for we are concerned that there won't be enough money available in order to support the number of closures in the years ahead. So it's a no fiscal impact item to the budget, but we think it's a high impact issue for some of the lowest income residents in some of the most affordable housing that we have in the state. So I went over the change items, but I also just wanted to make sure that I could remind the members of the committee of the other items that are available in the base, all of them that play a critical role in this continuum from homelessness to homeownership. So the Greater Minnesota Workforce Development Program at $4 million, the Housing Trust Fund at $23 million, preservation of federally assisted housing at $8 million, rental rehab at $7 million, homeownership assistance at $1.8 million, homeownership counseling, training, and education at $1.7 million, build wealth at $1 million, and building and support organizational capacity at $1.3 million. So the other piece, and equally exciting, was that the governor previewed the bonding bill. So The governor has proposed the largest housing bond in the history of any governor in Minnesota, $150 million in total. So if you take the base of the appropriated plus the new appropriations plus the bonding proposal, we're talking about over $280 million investments in housing. On the bonding side, the largest piece is $120 million in the housing infrastructure bonds, which would allow us to build or preserve somewhere around 1,100 to 1,300 rental units throughout the state. Again, I mean, this is just the beginning of what we need to do to solve the housing challenges across the state. But the housing infrastructure bonds are dollars that allow us to complete the deal, to make the deal pencil out, as they say, to make the math work, especially when you're targeting lower income Minnesotans. You know, the cost of housing has gone up, and in order to keep housing affordable to Minnesotans at all income levels, we need this extra support to do it. Minnesota has about 72,000 units of privately owned rental housing that have federal or state assistance in them. We need to think about the preservation of that stock. And there are about 31,000 of these units that are subsidized through the federal Section 8 program. I'll tell you, we spent an awful lot of time looking at that portfolio during the shutdown. You know, what does it mean to a property owner who is trying to keep housing affordable when the federal government stops paying the rent? I really feel like we averted a challenge by not going into a second shutdown, because these are some of the most affordable units that we have in communities all across the state. So $120 million for housing infrastructure bonds, and then $30 million for general obligation bonds for publicly owned housing preservation. One of the consulting projects that I had last year was with the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority, and taking a look at the high-rises. You know, many of them are as old as I am. They were built in the 60s and the 70s. And there's so much that could be done, not only around energy efficiency, but to really improve the quality of life for residents that live there. You know, the income of people that live in publicly assisted housing is less than $15,000 a year. Less than $15,000 a year. And so this publicly owned housing is absolutely critical, and critical to the healthy aging of the state.
And how did you determine that of that $150 million, that $30 million would go for that purpose as opposed to a higher number?
Ryan, I'm going to
let you, what you've just told me.
I'm going to let you take that question, Ryan.
Madam Chair, Ryan Baumtrag, Assistant Commissioner for Policy at Minnesota Housing. So the $150 million in the balance between how much is in housing infrastructure bonds and GO bonds was a little bit of a conversation with the governor's office about what tools do we think could we most readily get out into the communities, and at what time and at what scale. So wanting to make sure that the requests that we got and the authorization, that we could timely get those out. And so it is a balance between the two. It's also a conversation that we're having about how best to preserve public housing using what resources. So typically that's been with general obligation bonds and public, the public housing, the POP program, but it might be if we get additional resources with HIB that some of those could also be used for publicly owned housing. So we want to look at what's the right way to finance the improvements at what scale.
And the reason I raised that, in visiting with a city's representative yesterday, they know the urgency is so great, because in our testimony a few weeks ago, we were told all over the state the waiting list for this is 5 to 10 years. In most cases, that means they're not taking names anymore. And the cities are beginning to say, could they use their authority to do more local effort? And, of course, that's property taxes, which we, of course, try to avoid as much as possible. So that was my reason for raising that amount.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the federal government has disinvested in the public housing that they created in the first place is a huge local challenge. And it really is a community asset. because it houses the lowest income seniors and individuals with disabilities. And so figuring out how to preserve that federally produced housing is absolutely critical to what we do going forward.
And the one other thing I would just observe about this particular portion, Ms. Dyson, who isn't here today, pointed out to us that housing infrastructure bonds do not need to be in the bonding bill because it's an appropriation bond and so doesn't require a supermajority. So it could, in fact, be in a committee bill, which gives us a little more assurance that that would actually happen. And so I hope that's a discussion we have at some point with.
Madam Chair, at your wise counsel, we are speaking with the governor's office about that as well. So that is really the overview. I guess what I would like to close by saying before I take the questions is that when I was thinking about whether or not to put my name in to become the commissioner of Minnesota Housing, I had an opportunity to sit within the governor-elect and the lieutenant governor-elect. And I was just so impressed with their commitment to the idea that housing is foundational for everything that we do. And in the budget discussions, you know, I knew that education was number one priority, that health care was right up there, and community prosperity was number three. He had talked about it on the campaign trail. But what I deeply understood when I decided to put my name in is that the governor knew that you can't reach our education goals, you can't reach our health care goals, and communities can't prosper if we don't take a long view and solve the housing challenges that we're experiencing all across the state. So when the governor came out with the proposal yesterday to invest over $280 million in housing, the largest proposal by a governor ever on housing, I have to say, I'm lucky to be the housing commissioner. So I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Representative Salk has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm sorry, I was dreaming about my question. I've got two points that I'd like to have you illuminate. One is pretty direct, has to do with the mobile home or the mobile home park trust fund. I had come to understand in the last couple of years that one of the bigger problems in the trust fund being sustained and or growing was the system by which accounting is made and or funds are identified to be received. And I don't think it serves anybody's purpose to say, well, that was during this administration or that was that person's lack of performing their duty. That doesn't matter to me, to be honest. I'm more concerned that we have actually opened the book and said we have to look at the system of how we're intending to create that flow of money so that then we at least have a trust fund. So,
yeah, thank you, Representative Salk. Madam Chair, Representative, we have already begun the conversation with Minnesota Management and Budget about the best way to do collection for the Housing Trust Fund. Part of the challenge is that it's a little bit of an oddball for all of us in terms of how it works. We're interested also in bringing the Department of Health into that conversation because they have some registration in terms of knowing. Part of it is knowing everybody. Part of it is who communicates with everybody and then who has a collection mechanism. But we are working on the question across the agencies about the best way to make sure that collection happens efficiently.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you very much. That's exactly the line that had revealed itself to me. I'm late to this party, but also pretty experienced in life, and so some of these things sort of look to me like they're solvable as long as somebody starts to lean on it a little bit. The other question I have, and I'd like also just hear your elocution of your view of it. We have had lots of discussions with home builders and putting in front of them, and developers, I guess, that group, and putting in front of them, how are we going to solve affordable home issues? And then we all have a different scale that we're talking about when we say the word affordable. And frankly, builders want to solve building problems because that's their business. They make money. But I think that sometimes the dialogues about creating stock for housing our people, we ignore the issue that if we're going to be bringing product into the market, new places, new things, there has to be an opportunity for profit. It's like somehow we can make these numbers some arbitrary number that we have said we want houses to become available at $70,000. Well, you know, it ain't possible. No matter how much magic you hold, you're not going to get there. So at our level, how are we dividing up the dialogue so that somebody talking about we don't have enough homes in Minnesota isn't misunderstood to think that they are talking about affordable homes or that they are talking only about a certain price range? Because, frankly, if you've got builders and developers and you're thinking of them as a solution, you are, by definition, talking about well beyond 200, probably depending on your market, that region that you're talking about, well beyond 200 or well beyond 300,000 per unit. So sometimes I think that our dialogues are a little disingenuous in that we sort of conflate the whole thing as if all prices are to be talked about. I'm sorry, I go on. But.
Commissioner, any response to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Salk, you know, the cost of housing is a very complex formula. But the simplest way to think about it is that what people earn and what they can afford to pay on housing don't line up. And the cost of housing has continued to rise, and incomes have stayed pretty flat. And, you know, that is the fundamental issue. So how do we contain the cost of housing? You know, it's everything from looking at fees and permitting to really looking at technology and innovation. We build homes the same way that we built homes, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, we have a shortage of carpenters. People who build homes should make enough money to buy homes. You know, all of these things are factors in this. But I think that we also really have to just take a look at, yes, there is the what I'll call the minimum cost of having a housing market that can create housing that is high quality that people want to live in. You know, we have to always kind of be understanding what that is. We need to be looking at technology drivers to figure out if there's a way to streamline how it is that we build that housing. We're in dialogue with local communities to understand the added costs of fees and permitting, but it's also paying for the role that local government plays in housing construction, and we need to take a look at the incentives of the market. So yes, this is not an easy problem to solve, and it's a huge one. I guess what inspires me right now is it's one that's finally gotten the attention that it deserves, and it's not just by the governor and state government. It's by mayors and counties and businesses. I mean, I'm hearing from legislators and business leaders all over the state that housing is creating a employee recruitment issue. You know, we have communities, you know, Painesville, places where we have thriving, you know, business communities, but we don't have housing that's affordable to the people that live there. You know, I mean, I could. You know, Thief River Falls, Worthington. You know, I could name 100 communities that have already been, you know, called to attention for me, where the jobs are there, but the workers aren't. We're either busing them over from South Dakota, or we have people living in less than ideal situations because they have a job in a community, but there's not housing there, either that they can afford or there just isn't housing there. So, I mean, this is a statewide problem. And it's a hard one.
Representative Herr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I really appreciate the presentation and how thorough and broad it was and all the different things that you do within the department. I had a quick question around innovation, and I know you spoke just a little bit to that. But before I ask the question, I did just want to reiterate what you said that really resonated with me about the house being the main asset to build wealth, right? My family came to this country in the 70s, and we bought a house within the first year that we came to this country. And because of the building of that wealth in that home and our ability to build credit and our ability to understand what that meant, then I've never, my family's never rented a home in my entire life. And my first place I lived in, I actually owned. And so it's really critical that people have access to housing, because that's the only way that you break the intergenerational issues with poverty, and the fact that we as a country have excluded people of color from owning homes, the way we redlined, the way we allowed certain people to have access to loans. And so I think that us fixing the problem now is it makes the problem bigger, because we spent a huge part of our history excluding people from building wealth in this way. So I really appreciate that you touched upon all those things within your presentation. And that leads me to my question of that we is this the place for us to think about what it means to have some funding set aside for innovation, right? Because we do talk about how infrastructure, the IT, the technology, those things and the data and the information is really important. But if we don't dedicate funds to really allow us to have that space to look at new and innovative ways to do something, we're going to continue to operate within a structure that has existed for generations, right? And so I'm just curious if you have any thoughts around that, and if maybe this isn't the place for it, how can we invest in innovation in this particular area?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, first let me just say to home ownership that home ownership adds $10,000 of wealth to a family a year. And one of the conundrums, going back to what Representative Salk was talking about, one of the conundrums is, as a homeowner, I love it when the value of my home goes up, right? When the value of my home goes up, that is helping me accumulate wealth. It means that the house next door to me suddenly got more expensive for somebody who wants to buy it, right? And so there is this kind of conundrum, right? Those of us who are in home ownership, we benefit from the price going up. But as the price goes up, it makes it less affordable to people who want to move next door. And so, we just have to, we need to think about these issues. There's a lot of things that drive the cost of housing. We live in bigger homes than we used to live in. You know, my little brother lives in the house in Brooklyn Center that my mom grew up in. You know, that house used to hold five people. You know, now it holds two. We live in larger homes than we used to live in. And so that's a part of it as well. You know, with technology, first of all, I just want to say this is not an area that I have deep experience in, but I have a lot of curiosity, and it's an area where philanthropy and businesses are really interested in helping us advance technology. So the Itasca project, bringing together corporate leaders, is taking on technology and housing production as a priority area for them, and I'll be working with them on that. You know, McKnight and other philanthropic leaders are looking at technology and the technology of how we build homes and really taking that on. So I think that we have good partnerships with the private sector in terms of helping us make these advancements. I'm looking forward to learning more about some of the creative panel construction and other things that are happening that would allow us to bring down the cost, not only because of the build, but because of shortening the timeline, right? Time is money when you're dealing with development. And so if technology can allow us to shrink how long it takes to build, we're also bringing down the cost of housing. So thank you for your question.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to echo Representative Hurst's comments about your vision and how critically important this budget is, and how I think it is bold. It's something we've never seen before, so I really appreciate that. My question is relating to the local housing trust fund match. We know these trust funds work. I was involved in helping to create the one in Hennepin County as an advocate, and that was way back in the late 90s. Minneapolis has one. So I'm wondering, you mentioned 7 to 13 communities, and how are you going to select these communities? Is there like an RFP process, and how would these communities be able to access this matching money?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Ryan, can I
pass the floor?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. So this is a new, would be a new program, so we would have a competitive RFP for it. There was legislation passed by this body a couple years ago that authorized more trust funds to be and a little bit more clear direction on uses and intent, but it wasn't funded at the time to provide incentives. So this would be a new program. The 7 to 13 communities is a mix of how much we would incentivize or how much from the locals we would expect in order to get the match. So there's some details that we would need to figure out that we could be in conversation with about how to get new communities. I think that's the overall intent, is to get new communities to create one.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And it is an indication, though. I mean, we're starting, but boy, we still have a long ways to go. I mean, when you hear a small number like that and you realize the needs across the state. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. First, just want to thank you for the presentation and thank the governor for just the overall direction of this housing budget. As you said, I think there is a tension that's being put on this issue like never before, and that's a good thing. In particular, really appreciate the focus on the intersection between housing and education. I mean, I really think that that importance can't be overstated. You know, education is the largest area of our state budget, but if our kids don't have stability in the home, you know, they're really not in the best position to succeed. And so innovation in that realm and focus is so important. First question, it is great to see this large investment. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on, you know, the and you mentioned that this is just the beginning. The governor's task force last year, you know, laid out some pretty significant challenges and goals. Do you have thoughts on how this budget is helping to kind of meet what was laid out in the task force?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Howard, I mean, one of the things that we did in laying out the themes is that we've kind of bucketed them in line with what the task force recommendations were. I was involved. I had an opportunity to testify in front of one of the committees of the task force and followed that work. You know, one of the things that has been made the job of becoming the new commissioner easier is that strategically what Commissioner Tangerthal was doing for 8 years with Minnesota Housing and what I want to do with Minnesota Housing are directionally aligned. You know, I would love to turbocharge what it is that we're doing because it's a big problem and it requires a big solution. And so these investments are completely in line with the recommendations of the task force. One of the conversations that we are having internally, and I think it's day 45, so, you know, still getting up to speed a little bit. One of the conversations that we're having internally is what parts of these recommendations does Minnesota Housing own? And I think that because of the timing of the task force work and knowing that there was going to be a transition, there was maybe a little bit of hesitation for Minnesota Housing to raise their hand and own specific parts of this. I think that we lead by owning, and that by owning parts of this, we also have a stronger ask of the private sector in terms of what it is that we need them to do. So I look forward to having a conversation with you once I get my head around that completely. But I think that we need to own a part of it. But I'll say that this investment certainly makes the statement that we are ready to provide leadership. But we can't solve the problem by ourselves.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one follow-up comment. And this is as much to us at the legislature as to the administration, and it's to the point of what I see a bit of a blind spot, or blind spot's not the right word, but a need for more solutions in the realm of naturally occurring affordable housing. You know, we just looking at, you know, some of the figures of what we might be able to build in terms of new units or preserve of federally subsidized, you know, public housing in this budget. I just want to point to attention to a Met Council report just in the last couple of weeks that, we're losing over 1,300 units of, non-subsidized affordable housing annually. And so when you just sort of look at this battle of amount of housing and what's affordable in our state, our naturally occurring affordable housing. Just in Richfield, you know, we had 750 units gone like that. And speaking to the intersection of homes and kids, that displaced 150 students. And so I just raised the issue. I think it's again, a newer area of attention spot, but one that I think we need to be really concerned about and bring new policy solutions to bear. And I'd just be curious thoughts from the commissioner on that.
We have two more questions. Representative Tyson Fisher, and then we've got two bills to get to. So
I'll be really quick. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Howard, yes. Most of our preservation work has focused historically on publicly owned and federally assisted housing. And I think we need to figure out how to do preservation in places where that's not the case. So we're putting a lot of energy and focus on that right now. Look forward to talking with you more about that.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Hall. I just want to thank you again for visiting St. Cloud and checking in with the homeless problem in St. Cloud with the school district. And also thank you so much for visiting McKinley ALC. They are they absolutely have my heart, and I think I shared with you that when I win the lottery, my first purchase will be a home for the students there. It just means that much to me, so I really appreciate your work in that avenue. On the housing side, home builders are really glad that, yes, this is finally getting the attention, that it is a collaboration of all of us working together to make homes affordable. When we did have the recession, my company, we focused on remodeling, but I think up to 13 homes. We kept five of them, but we would just get them ready to be put back on the market again, making them more efficient and such. So, you know, not knowingly, we hopefully did our part to keep affordable housing in our community because the homes were all under $100,000. So I think that did happen to an avail. One of the things you'll hear economists say, too, that when housing turns around and starts being strong again, our economy will be stronger again. And I think a lot of us feel like it's not there yet, and we're hearing it's not there yet. So I appreciate the focus on housing. I appreciate the comments about we need to work together and get this solved. So just thank you very much for the work that you're doing.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner Hull. Thank you for the work that you folks are doing. I'm very excited about the focus on realizing it's a holistic approach we need to take on homelessness if we're going to address the education issue. The question I have is, I'm excited to see the investments that are being made here to address the housing problems we have in the state. What I'm wondering is, I know that in the homeless arena that the communities of color, Native communities, are represented much higher, six to eight times more than people who are Caucasian. As these dollars are going out, how do you rectify, particularly in the homeless area, are you making sure that they're lining up in the same statistical way to make sure that they're addressing the disparities that are out there so that the disparities aren't getting worse, but that we're increasing and meeting those needs going forward?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, last Thursday I had Lieutenant Governor Mayor Fry of the City of St. Paul, all seven metro counties electeds and appointeds at Minnesota Housing, talking about unsheltered homelessness specifically. If you are Native American in the metro area, there's a 27 times disparity mm-hmm. in representation in unsheltered homelessness. One of the things that I want to do at Minnesota Housing and with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness is to ask all of the state agencies to take a look at the way that we are distributing the funding that we have through a race equity lens. Homelessness has a enormous disparity issue, an enormous equity issue, and we really need to take a look at how we're funding and how we're providing services and our impact in addressing that. So it's something that I am very motivated to focus on in the coming years. Thank you for your question.
Representative Juergens gets the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I just want to go back to the rehabilitation loan program that Chair Hausman asked about, and 260 households per year being served when there's 51,500 and growing households that are eligible for that. How did you assess that program overall and whether or not it should even be continued, and maybe is it possible there's just a lack of interest in that program, and maybe the program should have been done away with and the money used elsewhere in one of these other programs?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I appreciate the program. One of the things that is the most humbling to me as I get to know the agency is the enormity of the need and the way that we contribute to meeting the need, that there is a big gap. The size of the program doesn't have anything to do with the size of the need or the desire of communities to solve the program. The size of the program has everything to do with just the scarcity of resources and how we choose to make investments. There are multiple strategies for figuring out how to meet this critical need. Habitat for Humanity, for example, has stepped up in this area of around home modification and helping seniors age in place. We don't solve these problems unless everybody does their part. And the state plays a critical role. We play a leadership role, but everybody needs to do their part. And that's why we think investments in this program are absolutely critical.
And so the point is that there would be some more of those 51,000 who would desire the help, but your resources only allow you to accommodate 260, as I recall.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So members, you have a little bit of information in your packets. The copy machines just couldn't generate them fast enough, so this afternoon you'll get the full copies of the budget report delivered, I guess, to your offices. Is that it? So that's still coming for you. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Pardon? Representative Johnson, you had...
Quick question, Madam Chair. I was wondering if the members could get a electronic copy of this. As we're all getting older, we have less trouble seeing this type. I can't even read, and the type is so small on the screen, it's also difficult to read.
That would be possible, I'm guessing?
Yeah.
An electronic absolutely. Copy of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Much.
I hope you all get home safely tonight.
Thanks. And Representative Nura, thank you for your patience. We obviously had a good bit of interest in the budget, so we're... do you have a preference about which bill you take first?
We'll start with 495.
495.
I have the students if they can come along.
And to get the bill before us, I will move House File 495. And there is an author's amendment, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for moving House File 495.
And to get the bill before you, in the A2 amendment is yours, is that right, to align the bill with what's moving in the Senate, I believe?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my amendment.
So I would further move the A2 amendment to House File 495. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and your testifiers. And
thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mahmoud Nur. I'm here to present to you House File 495. And the students who are with me will be identified themselves, and will. This is about tenants' rights. This is ensuring that when someone has a lease, that they know when that lease starts. Especially when you're a student and you're coming in the middle of the month, that you are going to have a lease that shows that you are being charged for a prorated rate, and nobody should be taking advantage because of, you're starting in the middle or you're living in the middle of the month. So we're creating an opportunity to include in the lease the time that the lease begins and the time the lease ends. This also allows for the tenants to choose the time of moving equal or same to the landlord, which is also defined in this process. Madam Chair and members, this bill was brought to you, to the House in the last session, and I wanted to bring in the students so they can speak in details about the issues of tenant rights and lease when they're students. This does not only impact students, it impacts so many people who usually have a lease and they don't have a home, and yet they have to go into deep trouble because of how the lease is structured.
And I'm assuming that somebody told you about a practice around here that when you have your first bill, you bring treats, because I didn't provide the treats, but I have a feeling you did.
Yes, indeed. It's coming around.
Thank you very much. I move. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jude Goosens. I'm currently an undergraduate student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. And I serve as the Director of Government and Legislative Affairs for the Minnesota Student Association, which is the undergraduate student government at the MNU. As Representative Neuer said, this bill was brought to you, was brought last year in session, primarily from the Minnesota Student Association, because this is an issue that does very strongly affect students, not that students are the only stakeholders in this process. But we see time and time again, and year after year, students coming to us with these different issues, coming to our university student legal services, who is charged with aiding students with legal conflicts and things like that, with landlord-tenant law, that students face these issues year after year, and it's becoming an increasingly difficult problem to handle, and it's becoming increasingly prevalent between short on leases, not knowing exactly what unit you're going to be moving into, not having the notices of rent increases or notice to quit deadlines aligning in the lease terms. And a lot of these different things, you know, in our student government work comes up again and again, that students really need to know exactly where they're going to be living. And when personally, when I went to sign my first lease when I was an incoming sophomore a few years ago, myself, like most other students, are signing a lease for the very first time. Unless you have, you know, the resources or the support outside of yourself to know exactly what you're doing, you get that stack of papers that are this long, that big, that you can sit there and you can, you know, go through and do your best to understand the terms of the lease, but oftentimes students don't have those resources. So when you go through and when the lease is not transparent about just simple things that you think ought to be the basic informational requirements of a lease, that when I was reading my first lease, I didn't see what unit I was going to be moving into. In these high-rise apartment buildings with dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of units, I didn't know which unit I was going to be moving into. The terms of the dates are often, the dates that you are going to be living there are often buried deep in the language of the lease. So I ended up having to find alternative housing accommodations for about 3 weeks, which students often colloquially refer to as homeless month or homeless week. This especially impacts first-generation students or international students who don't have those resources, that who don't have family or things in the metro area. A good friend of ours actually had to rent out an expensive Airbnb for those 3 months because they were an international student and really had no other alternatives. So just all these different issues, really, we've seen for years and years and years. And these affect not just the University of Minnesota Twin Cities students, but these affect our peers in Duluth and Crookston and Rochester and Morris and other colleges and universities all across the state, which is why we're here today in support of this bill.
And we have one other testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Grant Simons. I am the local advocate within the Government and Legislative Affairs. I work predominantly with local governments such as the City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, Hennepin County, and I can kind of keep going on and on about different local governments that are within our own boundaries, including neighborhood organizations. So I work very closely with housing. We were talking earlier about mayors getting a lot more interested in housing and where people live. And I'll tell a little bit of my story of my first time renting. I rented a place for $450. It was my own room. I was renting the room as its own spot, and you have to pay. It's pretty standard practice to pay first month's rent and last month's rent. So I do that. I pay first month's rent and last month's rent, and I don't really put two and two together that my lease is only going till August 20th. So you pay a full month of rent, but your lease is only going till August 20th. So that, and you're not getting any of that money back. You're paying $450, and it was $450 at the time, not paying $450 anymore for housing on campus, but you're paying $450, and you're only living there for 20 days when your lease says you're supposed to be paying $450 for a full month of living. So that's a problem that's pretty standard practice around campus. Even the best landlords are doing this, and people are shocked when I said last year that I was able to move out August 30th. Like, my landlord let me stay there until the end of the month. They're like, really? They did? Like, you could be there for that long? It's like, yep, that's how the housing really should be on campus. But unfortunately, it's not. And as Jude said, it really does affect a lot of the international students that are there because they don't have their parents' place in Eden Prairie that they can go to. I have my parents' place in the Eden Prairie to go to, but I have that privilege. A lot of kids that are coming on the campus, they have nowhere to go. They have to stay with their friends. They have to ask the university for housing, and it's really causing a lot of intertwined issues within this. I would add that as someone who has mental health, if I were told, and I'm probably going to maybe have to deal with this, I might be being somewhere until August 15th. I'm going to need to find 15 days for somewhere to live and then at the same time be trying to find housing and at the same time be trying to go to work at a job. And I like to live without a car, so I'll be trying to rely on public. There's going to be a lot of kind of issues within that. So from a mental health perspective, to have our resources not be overused in the state, if you don't want more money going towards mental health resources, if you want to save that for people who are really in need of assistance, we need to have what NOR is proposing, to have people have housing until the end of the month, and if they don't, to have repercussions because of that. So I thank you for your time today.
Representative NOR, Representative Munson has an amendment to your bill I think we'll address at this particular point. Representative Munson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative NOR, this is a bill that will directly raise the cost of rent. This committee is really focused on lowering the cost of housing in Minnesota. And I've been a landlord for 25 years. I moved to campus when I was a freshman at 17 years old at the University of Minnesota and got a job managing a 20-unit building and bought my first rental property after I turned 18, just a few blocks from the main gates of the U of M, and I've owned a lot of property around there. And every unit at the University of Minnesota, nearly every unit, starts their lease on September 1st and ends it August 20th because we need time to go in and paint and repair housing to make sure that housing is clean and safe for the next tenants that move in. Everywhere else in Minnesota, we have a move-out period where if somebody moves out at the end of the lease, that unit will sit vacant for a month. And so we have to adjust the cost of rent to make sure that the month that it sits vacant is kind of covered throughout the other part of the lease. So if you require that the property be empty for a month, then you're going to directly increase the cost of rent by almost 9% just from that alone. There are so many levers that we can pull to adjust the rent. I mean, we have the monthly cost of rent is what most people see, but there's a notice period. If I have a tenant who has, I think it was referred to as they have, you know, flexibility, or they don't know if they're going to be here long. Maybe they're going through a divorce, or they have a job that they're working in the Twin Cities for 6 to 12 months, and they don't know exactly when they're going to move out. I can be flexible to accommodate those people based on a notice period. If they're going to give me an adequate notice, then I can lower the cost of rent for them because my risk as a landlord is lowered. The lease length obviously impacts it. If somebody's going to be there on a 12-month lease, I can lower the cost of the rent. If they're going to be there month to month, I have to increase the cost of rent. The unit flexibility you spoke to, when I managed a large apartment building, and there were three units that were coming up in January, and somebody wanted to move in, a lot of times we get, I want to move in early if possible, maybe 10 or 15 days early. I don't know which unit is going to come available, so I may give them the option of choosing, and I will lower their rent, make it more affordable, if they don't have a preference in which unit they move into. And I've signed leases that way. So not knowing which unit you go into should be an option. It should be available for landlords to help lower the cost of housing and make it more affordable. The security deposit is also something that we're flexible on. I've had tenants move in with no money, no cash on hand for a security deposit, and they pay that throughout the course of the lease. And I write that into the lease, that they have to pay an extra $100 a month for 12 months, and I've had people that stay there years, and it works out for them. But it allows me to accommodate people that don't fit into the exact category of tenant that you would prefer to have as a landlord, but these tools allow us to accommodate more people and offer more affordable housing, and these are really important for us. Also, subleasing, which isn't brought up in here, but that's another thing that we allow people to sublease or not based on those terms. I mean, everything that we do to help tenants get into housing and make it more affordable them should be allowed as tools for landlords. On your notice where you say that we have to give people the same notice period, we have to give tenants the same notice period landlords have, That is a major tool for us that we use to make things more affordable. I have several properties where I don't allow tenants to move out in January, February, or March, because in my history in renting has shown I can't. The amount of people looking to move in Minnesota like today is pretty limited. So I can lower the cost of rent if they can't move out in a certain period of time, but that would apply here, and you would make that illegal. And by the way, this effective date on your author's amendment says that this section's effective the day following enactment of this bill and applies to existing leases. These are private contracts that I have between me and a tenant where we actually sat down and negotiated a way to make the rent more affordable for them, and they've agreed to the terms of this lease. And so you're going in there and taking an existing contract between me and a tenant and changing the terms. So in reaction to that, you're going to have landlords that have to increase the rent on tenants because you're taking away tools that allow us to offset risk. And in all likelihood, the tenants are going to follow these terms to give us proper notice, and that's how you have great tenant-landlord relationships. You don't want to take away these tools that we have to be flexible to accommodate people who are in difficult life situations. This is a terrible bill because it increases the cost of rent. And if this is rolled into the omnibus bill coming out of this committee is going to be making this an unaffordable rent, increase in the rent of housing.
To that last point, Representative Noor, my understanding is that the author's amendment fixes the last point he made, applies to all leases entered.
Chair and members, you might have to clarify what the last point you made is.
About the effective date.
The effective date in the author's amendment is that these sections apply to leases entered into on or after the date that this is enacted, except for the final portion of the bill, which is all leases But that has to do with the time period for notice to quit or rent increases, which wasn't one of the items that Representative Bunsen was discussing.
By the way, members, I moved the author's amendment, but we did not act on it, and so we really should deal with that. My understanding was the author's amendment was intended to align it with the way the bill is moving in the Senate. Is that my understanding?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And so if we could...
Madam Chair. Can I just clarify with the author's amendment? It says that it applies to all leases in existence or entered into after this date. And doesn't that go against the Constitution that changes leases in existence?
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, that's only for Section 3. For Sections 1 and 2, it's only prospective. It's only Section 3 that will apply to other leases that have been entered into, which is sort of the intention. That section of the bill hasn't been discussed at all yet. That's the notice of quit or rent increase. What it means is that if a lease tells you, the landlord, that he has to tell a tenant when the rent's going to go up, that can't be a shorter period of time than for the tenant needs to give the landlord notice that they're moving out. So it will apply to leases that exist, but not until after the enactment date.
So I'd like to just deal with just getting the bill in the form the author wants by adopting the A2 so that we actually have that language before us. If there's any further...
Well, Madam Chair, I think that if I have an existing lease that I've negotiated and I've lowered the cost of the rent because I'm asking the tenant to give me more notice than I give them, as part of the terms of an existing lease, this author's amendment, if we add it to this bill, changes existing leases. And I think that I don't believe it's constitutional to do that. And I'd like the House research to speak to that.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, retroactive statutes are prohibited when it comes to criminal penalties. When it comes to civil penalties under the law, it's quite a bit more complicated. It is problematic to amend existing contracts. And to some extent, this does amend an existing contracts. That's leases that have already been entered into. But in certain circumstances, it does happen in the world of consumer protection when there's valid public policy reason for it.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will wait for the amendment, the Otis amendment, to be accepted.
Okay, we have the A2 amendment before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
The motion, amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I get a roll call on that vote?
Well, you can do a division now. We can't do a roll call anymore, but we can do a division. Well, a division. All in favor of the author's amendment A2, please raise your hand. Those opposed? Okay. Author's amendment fails. So now we have the A19. Is Michael Dahl in the audience? I'm just wondering if Michael Dahl wants to speak to the A19. I had a phone call. Did you wish to speak to the A19? I had a phone call. Just checking. You're welcome to. All right. Okay. Yes, please respond to the A19. Who at the table would like to? Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, the A19 amendment, which has been introduced, I just wanted to say, Representative Munson, you are a good landlord. This does not happen every day, that somebody can give a tenant the prorated amount and be able to address some of the challenges that we just talked about. Let me pull out the amendment that you have. This process, it's not everybody who will come to the table and sign a waiver and say, this is something that I'm waiving. It's going to be abused by many people to just negate what I just talked about. If you want to know about the renting process of the U and the surrounding area which I live, the leases for September are being written today. Students are entering into a lease, into a unit that they don't know it's going to be available. Somebody will take advantage of them because they're desperate in need. In the surrounding area that I live, for a three-bedroom, it's $3,000. And even more, the tuition for students is going up because they cannot afford to pay for housing. We are increasing homelessness for the students. We're creating a barrier in our system. So this bill actually brings something that is essentially needed to protect the students, to protect low-income individuals who will not otherwise look at the lease. This is a protection for the consumers. This is a protection for those who are being taken advantage by individuals who have got more powers, more resources. It brings an equity into the system. It addresses a challenge that I see every day. I see so many people who are being evicted. I see many people who are crying every day, every month, because of a landlord taking advantage of a tenant. We need to protect that. And I feel the pain for people who cannot afford to really see what is in the lease. The young people. We haven't equipped them to deal with the challenges they're facing. So, Representative Munson, I agree with you. You're a good landlord. You address those challenges that I put into the lease. This bill protects them. And we need to get through this and make sure that we provide a protection that is essentially needed. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that we can approve the bill as it is with Otis amendment.
Representative Pearson, did you have were your comments to this point?
To the amendment, yes. In any contract law, this is a bargain for exchange. And the issue that I have with the entire bill and the reason that this author's amendment, I think, speaks to a palatable solution is simply, again, we talk about one Minnesota all the time, but you're talking about an issue that's very narrow to a specific subset of tenants within your jurisdiction, and the application is across the entire state of Minnesota. So the issue that I have with the bill and the reason that this author's amendment makes sense to me is when you go out into other parts of the state, there may be a complete reversal of the supply and demand chain. There can be a complete change in what you're seeing for tenants versus the available rental properties versus the capacity to fill those properties. And by implementing these rules, it really does just eliminate any of those tools, those abilities to negotiate, to specify, and to put into a contract terms that are advantageous to both the landlord and the tenant. You're removing those tools, and I just think that those accommodations should not be removed.
Representative Noor, because you have another bill that I think has all been worked out and we do want to move it out today, I'm inclined to lay this over and revisit it at an upcoming meeting so that we have a chance to get more clarity so that we can get to your other bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we'll lay this over, and thank you very much for being with us today, and we appreciate having you. I will now move House File 282, and that, as I understand it, has an author's amendment because there have been another number of stakeholders who have sort of worked out issues, and the A1 amendment deals with that. So I will move House File number 282, and I will further move the A1 amendment, which, and do you or one of the testifiers just want to help us understand the changes in the A1?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to present House File 282. This is a bill that decreases the fees for the manufactured home installers. This is inconsistent with the DALI, Department of Labor and Industry, which requested reduction for the fees for all the industries, but the manufactured homes were excluded. It also defines what a manufactured home is. I know we've talked about innovation and technology. This is something that we need to look into. You know, the modular homes are becoming the new vision for home ownership. It also provides an opportunity for us to look into the how we can address some of those issues. This bill also requests, as the commissioner had indicated, increasing the trust fund for the manufactured homes from $1 million to $3 million so that we can provide help. And mostly this will be paid by the fees that is collected from manufactured homes and mobile homes. So,
you have two testifiers, Mr. Brunner and Mr. Anderson. Who would like to go first?
Madam Chair, Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We represent the builders of manufactured modular homes. There are about 15 plants in the state. Manufactured homes are the state's largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing. We also represent the owners of manufactured home communities, as well as sales centers and lenders. The bill, the language in the bill, is from the 2018 session and was for the most part worked out. And we're, you know, simply bringing back what we had hoped would have been adopted last session. And as Representative Noor pointed out, the installer licensing fee provision is something that the Department of Labor and Industry has supported the last two sessions. The bill also would allow modular homes, which are different than manufactured homes, in that a modular home, while built in the same plant as a manufactured home, is built to the state residential building code. And what we've seen today are modular homes that are much smaller than manufactured homes with unique designs, and we like the ability to put a modular home in a manufactured home park as a way of updating housing stock, preserving manufactured home communities. The statute was written in the 1950s. It says manufactured homes are allowed, doesn't allow modular homes. So we worked with the Department of Labor and Industry, the League of Minnesota Cities on that language. We're still working with labor and industry on tweaking with the definition of a modular home, but we're about 99% there with that. The other things that the bill would do is make changes to the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. The amendment to the bill sort of tightens up the focus of what we're concentrating on in terms of trying to keep things moving forward relative to the trust fund. It extends some borrowing authority to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency in case there is a shortfall. Going forward, we certainly do support increasing the cap on the fund from $1 million to $3 million. That's going to require a little language work based on the amendment, but we certainly support that. It does streamline the reporting process. The question was asked when the commissioner was testifying about how these invoices are mailed out to the owners of manufactured home communities not having good information. One of the things the bill does is require the Department of Health, which does licensing of these manufactured home parks, as well as the few locals, I believe like 16 counties, municipalities have their own licensing operations for manufactured home parks, requires them to report to MMB all addresses, number of home sites, so that for invoicing purposes, MMB is able to send out to an accurate list rather than not having updated and current information. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, did you have further testimony to add?
I just very quickly wanted to thank Representative Neuer for bringing the proposal forward, and I appreciate that he worked with Mr. Bruner and I to make these last-minute changes. With the amendment, it absolutely has our support. We certainly appreciate the comments made earlier by the commissioner and members of the committee, such as Representative Salk, and hopefully some of these additional improvements will be made in the future, but we support the proposal as it's coming forward with the author's amendment.
And so the author's amendment is before you. That's A1. Representative Munson, were you to the author's amendment or to the bill?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Knorr for bringing this forward and for bringing a bill that would lower the cost of housing, and that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. The author's amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the author's amendment is adopted. And the bill is before us, and this has already been to the Jobs Committee, and so we send this back to Ways and Means, and I think from there to the floor, as I understand it. Any further speaking to the bill? Closing comments for...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to addressing the home ownership issues with this bill. So thank you so much. Appreciate it.
So I will renew my motion that House File Number 282 be passed as amended and be referred back to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That bill passes. Thank you very much for your help. And members, I think we are adjourned.